Welcome back to the program. In this holiday season, as people shop thinking that it will bring them happiness, and in just a few weeks make resolutions for a new year which they hope will be happier, most are missing the essential point. Where does happiness really spring from? And where and how have people around the world really found true happiness? As he did in his book, The Blue Zone, our guest Dan Buettner has traveled the world looking for examples of real happiness. Dan Buettner is an internationally recognized researcher, explorer, and author. He founded Blue Zones, a project of Quest Networks, to research and publicize the world's best practices, and it is my pleasure to have him back here on the program today. Dan Buettner, thanks so much for joining us.
I'm delighted to be here.
Good to have you back. How do we define happiness? It seems like that would be the first object of the exercise, to figure out what it really means.
Well, I work with National Geographic and three huge databases, including Gallup and a big one in Europe called the World Database of Happiness. And what they do is aggregate something called well-being surveys and subjective well-being surveys. What they do is they go send out teams of surveyors in 121 countries. They find at least 1,500 randomly selected people, and they give they ask them questions, a few of them being a variation of the following. On a scale of 1 to 10, where do you place your own happiness? And it turns out that, and several other studies have been done, that people very accurately answer that question. And then there's 80 or 90 other questions which ask people about their values, religiosity, how much they make, relationships. So you can find out with these tens of millions of data points what sorts of things accompany happiness or people who say they're happy. And from that, you can distill out a prescriptive.
Isn't there a disconnect sometimes between what people perceive as transitory happiness and more permanent, sustained happiness?
Yes, there's a big disconnect. There's only about a 0.5 correlation. In other words, when you think about happiness, there's our remembered happiness, how we assess our life in the past, and it turns out that we only remember about 3% of our past, and we tend to remember the high points and the low points and the last thing that happened. So when it comes to a new car, we'll remember driving it off the lot and that wonderful smell of a new car and what a thrill it was, but we forget the car payments and the insurance payments and having to bring it in. And so we often will make our decision on what to do forward instead of buying a used car, which makes a lot more sense because financial security is more important than consumption. We'll remember what that new car smelled like and we'll make a decision to buy a new car. Experience happiness is different. And what we feel moment to moment is very different from what we remember when it comes to happiness.
The other part of the equation is how much of the events that surround happiness can we actually control?
About 30 to 35% of our happiness is dictated by genes. And then there's 15 to 20% that's dictated by circumstances in our lives. If we happen to be born with crushing depression or chronic pain, there's not much you can do about it. But about 50% of our happiness is really up to us, and we can influence that. And this book, Thrive, asserts that the only way to authentically get happiness is to set up your surroundings in the right way. There's no silver bullet, but there's silver buckshot. And while positive psychology or appreciation journals or motivational courses might give you some tools to be happier in the short run, most of us will forget about them after a few months. And the key is to set up permanent or semi-permanent nudges and defaults in our lives.
How much of it is attributable to the fact that geography is kind of destiny? In other words, if you're born in the Sudan versus born in Singapore, there's a pretty fundamental difference in what you're going to be dealing with.
It's huge. If you think of happiness as a cake recipe, and there are ingredients, there's, did I marry the right person? Do I have a fulfilling job? Do I make enough money to cover my basic needs? Do I have health? Do I have some security with health and finances? The biggest variable, the biggest ingredient in that recipe is actually where you live. And you find if you take people from an unhappy place, say Moldavia or Zimbabwe, and move them to a very happy place like Denmark, they very quickly start reporting the levels of happiness of their adoptive home. Now, where it gets interesting here is a lot of places we think are happy really aren't. So the focus of my book was to find the data-backed areas in the world where people are measurably happier.
And when you look at the world, where are those places? Where are the places that there's a significant increase in happiness as a result of sense of place?
Well, there's a big concentration of them in Northern Europe, but we found the happiest place in the world in a place called Aarhus, Denmark, northern part of Denmark. But then we also realized that different things make different people happy. There's a set of universals, but then there's a layer of cultural aspects. So we wanted to find the happiest place in Asia. We figured we'd be making a trip to Bhutan, where there's a happiness index, or Fiji, where there's beautiful sand and sun and laid-back people. But actually, the happiest place in Asia is Singapore, an island nation with a huge economy and about 5 million people. The happiest place in the Americas, north and south, we found in and around Monterrey, Mexico, northeastern Mexico. People there report higher levels of happiness. Happiest place in America, then, it's kind of a subset. We actually found them in San Luis Obispo, Central California, not too far from where you guys are, actually.
What is it about Singapore that makes it such a hotbed of happiness?
Yeah, so it's a hotbed for Asians. And we have to remember, Asians march to a slightly different drummer than people who grew up in the West. They're less individualistic and more collective as a rule. They more like to have life laid out very neatly for them. And the way Singapore's set up, they know what school they need to get into, they know what kind of job, they know what kind of club they're aspiring to, and if they hit these benchmarks, it gives them a sense of satisfaction. But also, it's a very secure place. Not a lot of freedoms to buy pornography or start up your own political party, but a woman can walk down any street at midnight and not be afraid they're going to be accosted. You can feel free to let your kids run and play in the playgrounds, know they're not going to be kidnapped. Very low crime rate, but then again, you lose some freedom. So it's an evolutionary reality of the human species that we will favor security over freedom.
Is that a recurring theme when one looks at the places where you find the higher happiness index, that there is this trade-off between safety and freedom?
It doesn't necessarily have to be a trade-off between security and freedom. Denmark, for example, has both freedom and security. But if you only can pick one, if you live in a place where unless you have really strict laws, you're going to have people misbehaving, then you should pick security over freedom. But the ideal is to have both. But security will trump freedom.
Talk a little bit about Monterrey, Mexico. That's a place that one would not think of as having a high degree of happiness.
Yeah, if you stand on the border of Texas and look south at the border there, where lots of immigrants come from, they're actually traveling through this region. They often come from southern Mexico. Monterrey and the Nuevo León, that area, is actually the richest part of Mexico. There's higher health care, there's better education, more social security, more employment. And that seems to have kind of an optimal balance of lots of social interaction and enough work to get by. But you also, of course, there are stresses. There people do have financial stresses, and it's come under siege from the drug gangs lately. But they have these powerful coping mechanisms, huge expanded families that include not just mom, dad, and the kids, but also cousins and godparents and aunts and uncles. So there's always that financial safety net, that stress buffer, and that constant nudge to get you out of the house and go into another wedding or another birthday party or another quincella. And that area teaches us the power of religiosity. And we know that the world over, religious people tend to be happier than non-religious people. It doesn't matter what religion you are, but being part of a faith-based community, like 85% of people in this area are, seems to stack the deck in favor of happiness.
What about the influence of globalization and communication? We live in a world today where certainly there is greater influence from every place to every place else. That's a dramatic change.
Well, I think to the extent that it gets countries to a level where they have food, shelter, basic access, some health care, a little bit of mobility, that's very important. When globalization starts pushing out face-to-face interactions, that's when we get into trouble. Facebook and Twitter do not replace the human contact that we evolved with. The happiest people in the world get about 7 hours a day of social interaction. And if we're sitting in front of our computers instead of out at happy hours or dinners or going to clubs or volunteering, that's a bad influence.
Mm-hmm. Talk a little bit about in these places where there is a higher level of happiness, people in those places that are not experiencing that and how that disconnect works.
I think the key to happiness is having these environments that nudge you into the right behaviors. I look at San Luis Obispo. It used to be the main streets had lots of traffic, lots of noise, lots of pollution, narrow sidewalks, and they slowed traffic way down so people find alternative routes because it's not fast to drive through the middle of town. Sidewalks are 16 feet wide, so wide enough to have outdoor cafes. So you just bump into more social interaction.
Mm-hmm.
So the thing is, it's not necessarily globalism. It's unenlightened leadership. And enlightened leadership, the leaders who pay attention to what correlates to happiness in nations have a great blueprint to make their cities better or to make their states better or even to make their countries better. And I think that's the big point.
Is that leadership from top down or from bottom up?
I think it needs to start at top down. On the national level, it needs to. There are lots of policies the United States could be doing to make us more happy. Most of the time, countries try to maximize gross national product as a measure of health and well-being of a nation, but that's actually a very blunt instrument. Reducing unemployment should be increasing trust, increasing lowering corruption, increasing the being able to count on police, increasing tolerance, letting all people, no matter what ethnicity or sexual inclination you have, of feeling accepted. Those things are very highly correlated with happiness in every country, and that's what national leadership could be doing.
When we look at places like Denmark and even Singapore to some extent, there tends to be a more homogeneous population. To what extent is that part of the equation?
It's a part of the equation in Denmark, where it's mostly, you know, white, blonde-haired people. But Singapore is actually Chinese, Indian, and Malay people. And Lee Kuan Yew, the prime minister, when he was prime minister, he took all their languages away and brought in English as the lingua franca, so everybody was on equal setting. So my point is there's a way to create homogeneity or kind of a common bond between people. And just because there's a diverse population doesn't mean you can't make connections.
Mm-hmm. What about any difference between urban and rural life?
Worldwide, people who live in cities are happier than people who live in rural areas. And that could be for a couple reasons. One, getting the right spouse is hugely important. First of all, getting married being married, you're three times more likely to be happy. But marrying the right person.
For some people, that would be hard to believe.
And we all know a few of them. But I'm talking averages. I'm talking about stacking your deck in favor of happiness. So if you're single or divorced or widowed right now, you're going to stack the deck in favor of happiness if you look for and finally commit to somebody in your life. It's not a guarantee, but you're more likely than if you just live life by yourself. Getting married, I think, is a real important part of the whole happiness equation.
What is it about religious communities that create greater happiness? Seem to, at least.
Number one, you're less likely to engage in the risky behaviors like alcoholism, drug use, and crime, which lead to unhappiness. Two, you have ritualized stress reduction. That's sort of a de facto meditation. We know that centering yourself and slowing down your brain is generally good. You have a built-in social network. Isolation almost always equates to happiness, so at least you have one group of people that you can count on every weekend. And then there just may be some effect of faith. We don't know that, but overall, and these three things are just conjectures on my part, but I can tell you for sure is, on average, religious people are happier than non-religious people.
Is there a sense that if this survey were done repeatedly, let's say 10 years from now and 10 years after that and 10 years ago, that in fact the results might be significantly different in terms of place?
Depending on the place, yes. There's absolutely no question. My book, Thrive, looks at successive waves. These surveys actually have been done in Europe since World War II.
Mm-hmm.
The World Value Surveys in America has been doing them for at least 20 years, and Gallup's World Poll does them every 3 or 4 years, they're called, and they change. In fact, Costa Rica edged out Denmark this past year as the happiest place, according to the World Poll.
Hmm.
But we chose Denmark because since 1960, it has consistently been at the very top. You know, it happens to be second now, and Costa Rica kind of came out of nowhere. So we believe that Aarhus, Denmark, was more consistently happy than the sort of gyrations you'll see from year to year.
What role does education and an educated population play in happiness?
Education is actually weakly correlated to happiness.
Huh.
We need some education, but you're not going to be, on average, a lot happier if you have a graduate degree than if you have a just plain college degree. So it's worth it to get some level.
Does that surprise you?
Yes, it does surprise me.
Why do you think that is?
Well, I think perhaps we overthink things. that I think perhaps people who get too much education end up getting jobs that are really stressful and demanding, and they push out the components of our life that more dependably yield happiness, like volunteering, like the 7 hours of social interaction. We know that women are more happy when they marry men whose focus is family over focus is success, for example. So it might be that people who are getting high degrees are these success-focused people and kind of miss the point of life.
You talk about the importance of social interaction. Does that apply also to online social networks?
Yes and no. I think if you live in an isolated place or you're handicapped and you can't get out of the house very easily, it's better than nothing. But for the most part, if you're doing Facebook at the expense of FaceTime, you're dealing yourself a blow when it comes to happiness.
Are there areas of the world that you see that are kind of up and coming in the happiness quotient?
Well, Mexico, I think, is continuing to get better. Mostly the southern part of Mexico. Central America, for sure, in general. I can't say much about Africa and happiness.
Right.
Yes, the former Soviet republics, when the Soviet Union collapsed, those countries took a huge hit, and they're on their way up as well. They were among some of the least happy places, and they're gradually inching back up.
And what about the U.S.? How do we fit into all of this?
The U.S. They get about a B-. Given all of our resources and all the potential for creating a happy population, we just do a fair job. We can learn a lot from happier places around the world.
Mm-hmm. Are there places that you have found in this research and in this study that we can learn from that are profoundly unhappy, that sort of do all the wrong things, that can help us better learn about this?
Well, certainly in a place like Zimbabwe, when you take away economic freedom, that's more important than political freedom on the world stage. Another really important thing is the feeling of security. Iraq is one of the least happy places, and it's sort of stolen. I think these fundamentals are that the most unhappy place in the world, they're places where you don't feel trust for your neighbor, you have corrupt governments, you don't have a feeling of security, people of different ethnicities or different tribes are not tolerated. They almost always dependably show you the exact opposite of the happiest places.
Dan, I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
I was, shall we say, very happy to talk to you.
Okay, thank you.